or voices.
Welcome to Animal Voices, the weekly program which endeavors to increase understanding and compassion for all living creatures. This show is presented through the cooperation of three local societies, Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection, Earth Save Canada, and the Vancouver Humane Society. Ideas expressed in the program are not necessarily those of the groups named. My name is Marge Adams. In the studio with me are co-host Kelly Harris and technician Alan Jensen. At the top of the show today, Kelly Harris will be interviewing Dr. Colin Campbell, who is with the Sierra Club, and their subject will be the environmental impact of eating meat. Later in the hour, we will be discussing the outrageous act of animal cruelty that occurred last Tuesday in the West End of Vancouver. We also will have some musical interludes and an animal story. Now, I expect that our guest will be calling in very shortly, but in the meantime, Kelly has something with her, I believe.
Well, that's right. I'll give you a little background on our guest today. His name is Dr. Colin Campbell. He's originally from Melbourne, Australia, so he's been in Canada for a long time, but I think you will hear a slight Australian accent. Dr. Campbell is trained in zoology and paleontology and got his PhD in Berkeley, California. His environmental concerns, which drive his career today, developed due to a professional fascination with the extinction processes. He spent the 1990s at the Australian National University studying international climate change and sea level research, traveled to places like Papua New Guinea, China, as well as Australia. Dr. Campbell returned to Canada in 1998, where he was involved with the BC Environmental Network from 2000 to 2003. And that was when he joined the Sierra Club, which is where he is today. Dr. Campbell is currently the Marine Campaign Coordinator at the Sierra Club of BC, and he's also the Science Advisor to the Sierra Club of BC. So it's an honor to speak with him, and I believe he's on the phone. Hello, Colin Campbell. Are you with us?
I'm with us. Hi, Kendall.
Hi there. How are you?
Well, thank you.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
I just have a couple questions to start with. Alan, can you turn up the volume on Dr. Campbell in my headphones so I can hear him?
Okay.
So, Colin, we're going to talk today about specifically the environmental impact of meat eating. Those of us involved in the show and our listeners are very concerned about animal welfare, and we're all aware that the way that we eat food definitely contributes to the harm done to animals. And I guess I'll start out on a general question. That's perfect, Alan. Thank you. That reducing our carbon imprint has become a trendy, much talked about goal these days. I've heard something crazy that I'd love you to speak about. I've heard that if you want to reduce your carbon imprint, that it's better to stop eating meat than to stop driving your car. Is that true? And if so, why?
Well, as far as I know, it is true, and I've looked at a couple of sources of data on that. One is from Japan. They have an institute of, livestock and grassland research. But in Britain, a candidate for the parliament, Chris Goodall, who ran for the Green Party from Oxford, presented some calculations, and it goes like this. It said, if a human being walks 5 kilometers, you need to burn 180 calories of energy. And if you got that energy from meat, then you'd need to eat 100 grams of meat, which is not that much. It's a bit less than 4 ounces. But the present way that we do animal husbandry and raise beef would cause the production of nearly 4 kilograms of CO2 for every 100 grams of beef that actually reaches the table.
Wow. Whereas can you say that again? How much CO2?
Well, an average vehicle, and here's the final point, an average vehicle traveling the same 5 kilometers in Britain would produce less than 1 kilometer.
Wow.
One kilogram, pardon me, of CO2. So it's about a quarter. So here we have this bizarre argument that if you're a meat eater, it's better for you to drive your car, and if you're a vegetarian, then you probably can afford to walk.
That is insane.
It is crazy, isn't it?
Well, and you mentioned the energy cost of producing meat. I've heard this very interesting idea that we are literally eating oil as we consume the food that we're eating because of the oil that it takes to produce the food. It takes oil literally to feed our nation, and I think it's not as much talked about. I'm just thinking about this Al Gore documentary. I don't think he ever mentioned, I don't know, Marge, did you see that documentary?
Yes, I did.
He didn't really talk about the importance of cutting down on meat, but that's a huge, huge way that we can help our environment. So in terms of, eating oil, using oil to produce our food, what kind of implications are those for our country, and should we be worried about that? Should we be worried about our reliance on oil to produce the agricultural and the animal products that we eat?
Well, I would say yes, and for two main reasons. One is that at some point we're all cognizant that oil is going to become limiting. And the figures for, and the other point that I'll come to second is that just the sheer amount of oil that actually used in agriculture as a greenhouse gas issue. Mm-hmm. But going back to the first point, it's been, it was in the late 1800s when the world's population was last fed by what we could call a solar agriculture, where all the energy and food was directly from the sun. The sun now, not the fossil sun that we get from fuel. And by 1950, we had basically used up all the available agricultural land on the planet, and the so-called Green Revolution came along. And I think it's important to understand what the Green Revolution was and what it wasn't. I mean, three things happened. There were new hybrids of food that were very efficient at putting energy into seeds. But there were fertilizers that came from natural gas and oil that literally replaced the nutrients that plants would normally get from the soil, sometimes by 50 or 100 times. And we also used it to kill off the competition, which was mostly insects, and we did that with pesticides. So here we are producing anywhere from 50 to 100 times the food that we could naturally produce, and the energy in our food is directly from the chemical energy and fossil fuels. And it's a huge subsidy, and it's a very dangerous dependence for the future, I think.
Very dangerous, very dangerous. It's funny they call it the Green Revolution, because it sounds like it was detrimental to our environment in a way, isn't it? All the use of all these nitrogen fertilizers.
Well, yeah, it has. Not only has it put us in this position of high dependence on a resource that can't last forever, but just the way that it's done, it's like literally it makes no economic sense in an oil-based agriculture to retain the natural ecology of the soil.
Right.
It's like, the natural productivity of the soil has been forced to such artificially high levels by oil that once you depend on those levels, a healthy soil actually becomes an economic liability. Now, we can refine that argument a bit later on, but that's sort of the quandary we're in at the moment.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. I just can't believe we're producing 50, 100 times more food than we could normally produce, and without anything like crop rotation. It's all with fertilizers. It just leads me to my next question about thinking about agriculture and America's biggest crop, which is commodity corn. Is what a lot of people don't realize is actually completely unpalatable in its unprocessed state. Commodity corn that they grow in the States, and we grow more wheat in Canada, but to a certain extent we also do produce some corn. But it's not the corn on the cob that we eat. It's kind of an inedible, very starchy corn, and it's raw material that's used to make high fructose corn syrup and as well as animal feed. So it just seems really crazy to me when I read this that most of what we grow on our land gets fed right to the animals. Can you just talk a little bit about that and, what that phenomenon reflects, and is it a bad thing, which is my first thought. This can't be good.
Well, that's a tricky question. I don't think it's good. I think it's done a couple of things that have put our security, our food security, in jeopardy, and not just that, but our own health. I mean, I think we have to realize that since they figured out how to make corn syrup as sweet as it is, which was a chemical invention about 40 years ago, then we've pumped that stuff into everything. And the greatest source of sugars these days is mostly in soft drinks, in liquid state, high doses of very pure sugars, and it's totally related to the incidence of diabetes and obesity, and that's something we really should consider. But the other point is that, yes, you're right. Here we have all this agricultural land that could be used to grow a high diversity of vegetable crops. It could be done in a way that regenerates the soil and keeps the biodiversity in a better state. And yet we're feeding 80% of it on feedlots to cattle mostly, and they don't even like it. We have to pump them up with antibiotics just so that they won't expire too soon for us to eat them. It's a very unsatisfactory and bizarre way of dealing with food, in my opinion.
That's crazy. And I read a statistic that in an article that you shared with me, Dr. Campbell, that in terms of energy production, it takes 35 calories of fossil fuel to make 1 calorie of beef and 68 calories of fossil fuel to make 1 calorie of pork, which just blew my mind.
Well, that's right. I mean, if you start from the bottom, it's about 10 to 1 for plants, 10 units of fuel energy for 1 unit of food energy. And, of course, every time you go up the food chain, there's a certain amount of waste, right? Organisms produce heat and all that stuff. And so what they actually preserve as edible tissue is only about 10%. So every time you go a step up the food chain, you lose about 10% more. And then it's inherently quite wasteful. You know, not all the food gets eaten either. So, yeah, you're right. And you're in the position where, like for breakfast cereal, you use 5 calories of oil for a calorie of breakfast cereal. And I would argue it's probably 10 calories.
It probably is, yeah, by the time we drive to the store and pick it up and they ship it.
Well, there is that. You know, that's huge, and that's another piece of it. But, you know, in a box of cornflakes, you know, you've probably got less than 10 cents worth of grain product, and it sells for, what, $3 or $4? So this is why it's done. You know, the industrial food chain, as opposed to the natural food chain, is massively profitable, and it's highly contained by just a few big companies.
Oh, very interesting. Now, the way we grow food and raise animals and as well fish our waters, and I know that fishing is an area, fishing in the oceans is an area you have a lot of experience in. The way we grow food, raise animals, and fish our waters is extremely wasteful, isn't it? And was just wondering if you could comment a bit about that. And, you know, you had mentioned that we're producing 100 times more food than we could actually normally produce. And, yeah, just wondered about your thoughts about that.
Well, that's right. We've covered a little bit of it already. I mean, the key element about why it's wasteful is because it's subsidized by oil, and oil has, you could say it has better uses, although these days we've got to try and figure out how to use less of it overall anyway. While we're trapped in this subsidy cycle of subsidizing, giving energy to the natural systems, it doesn't mean we're completely trapped, and we might come to this a little bit further on, but we need to think about some of the more refined organic methods that have been developed, including permaculture and so on, that actually can increase the productivity without using fertilizers. But let me just talk a bit about fisheries, because the Sierra Club does have we're a member of what's called Sea Choice. And if anyone wants to look at this, you go to seachoice.org. And this is a service, really, so that you can choose those fish that we have, by close examination, determined are raised reasonably sustainably, those that are marginal, and those that you shouldn't touch. So it's a, you know, it's a red, yellow, green classification.
Great. That's not something that people often think about when they go to buy fish.
That's exactly right, because fish is a good source of protein, and it's one that a lot of the world relies on. But, you know, fisheries are different from the discussion we've had so far. Fisheries are, I call it, the last great hunt. You know, these are wild animals.
Yeah.
And But you know, here we are 10,000 years after the agricultural revolution, and we're just kicking off the aquacultural revolution. Like, really, although there's a big debate in BC about aquaculture, especially of salmon, which we can talk about if you'd like, but really, we do need to culture fish to give the oceans a break. We've taken so much biomass out of the oceans that we're threatening their ecological integrity, and I would argue from a completely another direction that that's the last thing we want to do, because the oceans have such a key role in regulating our atmosphere.
Right.
And we just don't need them unhealthy at the moment.
Now you say that we could give the oceans a break and just do, you know, I guess just do aquaculture, so that's fish farming, right?
But yes, but you've got to sort of refine it a bit. And I mean, ideally what you would do is freshwater herbivorous fish, right? Fish that eat plant material, and you can contain in ponds in fresh water, so we can sort of let the oceans recover.
Right,
you know,
because
if you think about salmon, mm-hmm. salmon is the equivalent of raising something like tigers for steaks, you know? Hmm. These things are top carnivores mm-hmm. and hugely inefficient. And the way we feed them is, well, they do get some corn, but mostly what they get are smaller fish stripped out of the oceans where they would be well better left to grow up. And even then, I have to condition that statement by saying most of that fish meal goes to feed pigs and chickens anyway. But by adding another demand on the source of fish meal, we're putting more pressure on the oceans again. So,
and another danger with the fishing, I know I read this, with the salmon that we're farming here in BC, by the time in the next 4 years, we might kill off our natural source of salmon because of the sea lice that is present on these farmed salmon. Which
well,
is quite frightening.
That's true for one particular set of runs up in the Broughton Archipelago, I believe, where the fish farms are very unwisely sited right on the river mouths where the young salmon come out. And, of course, the lice that concentrate on this big captive herd of fish very easily find their way onto these juvenile fish, and they do them a lot of harm. So, mm-hmm. you know, we've known for some years that Norway, which used to have the most fantastic Atlantic salmon in their short, fast rivers, have lost them. And Scotland have lost most of their sea trout, and they know that it's due to fish farms. And they can't believe we're still doing what we're doing in BC. It's like, you know, how many mistakes do you have to make before you learn?
Yeah, really, we have all these great examples, and we're just...
Yeah, exactly so.
Yeah, well, definitely we'll have our viewers, our listeners check out seachoice.org for some wiser fish choices that we can make. And also in relation to food, I wanted to talk with you a little bit about the local food movement. A lot of people are talking about the importance of eating local and how that's becoming more important than eating organic. So, you know, could we talk about that a little bit and maybe relate it to also the way we raise animals?
Yeah, well, I think that there wouldn't be much local agriculture that wasn't organic. I suppose it's possible, but the two things do seem to go together. And
yes.
You know, let's start at the beginning. I mean, there's sort of two ways that oil is used in agriculture, in fertilizers and pesticides and in transportation. So organic agriculture manages the health side of that issue by keeping the pesticides and fertilizers and so on and regenerating soils and growing our food in a more natural system. It's inevitably better for us.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that smart to have a lettuce grown that way, trucked up from Southern California.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's the health of our bodies and there's the health of our planet, and I think we need to keep both in mind these days. So local agriculture tends to address both these issues, the nutrition issue and the greenhouse issue, especially around transportation. And with regard to animals, domestic animals for meat, I just think local raising of animals is inherently more respectful. I mean, they're part of your farm. You're feeding them stuff that you grow. You're probably using their manure as part of the cycle. And it changes, I think, an animal's life when it's seen for its real role, other than it's just product value at the end. And so, although, you know, it may not be a happy end to be slaughtered for food, I think even that can be done respectfully. And BC, unfortunately, at the moment, has introduced some legislation that prevents people from doing that terminal end of the business on their property. So if you happen to live on the Sunshine Coast and your neighbor's raised an animal and you would be happy to buy that for meat, then that, instead of the whole thing happening right there, it has to be shipped off the coast, you know, given that kind of stress, and then shipped back. And I think that's for people who are conscious but still carnivores, I think that's a worthy campaign to get into.
Definitely, definitely. I know that our other co-host, Carl, who's not with us, is quite involved in the animal transport issue. And with the consolidation of that industry, it's becoming a bigger issue. All these small farms going under with the rising cost of oil, and they're all being taken over by these big businesses who have one slaughterhouse way over in Manitoba or something.
Yeah, that's right.
And these poor animals are transported for 18 hours at a time. So,
you know, that last point you mentioned I think is important. And I mean, given what's going on with the atmosphere and with oil, this is really a time when we need to reacquire the skills of local living in a way. And, you know, having people actually learn to re-enter their own food chain is not just a consciousness-raising exercise. It's practical.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of the source, really, in humanity of our sense of community. I mean, when what we do is specifically what we need, and we do it inside the dynamics of the living planet, then I think we have a healthier culture. And I think this is one of the great virtues of local agriculture. And in fact, there's even some literature appearing now where the organic farming community is being prompted to become far more political because they contain a solution that we're going to need in the future, and they need to be getting it out there in
That's
a
right.
more active way.
Yeah, and also related to this idea of community and buying local is that farmers markets are such an amazing source of such an amazing wealth of information. I went to some farmers markets earlier this month, and I learned all kinds of things about products, you know, species of vegetables I didn't even know existed, and, you know, ethically raised feta cheese and all kinds of things. And it's so important to support those farmers because they don't get enough respect, but they are just a wealth, like a fount of knowledge.
And it feels different being there than walking through the aisles of your local supermarket.
Definitely, definitely.
Very convivial kind of experience, yeah.
Well, Colin, it's been so interesting to speak with you, and I'm just, I guess, wondering, just to finish off, I'm just... You know, looking at the way we raise food, all this, you know, corn and wheat and soybeans that are going to feed animals, 80% of our agriculture gets fed to animals who are raised in deplorable, abusive conditions, and the oil that we're consuming and polluting our environment with all these nitrogen fertilizers. Is there a way to cut this cycle and go back to, as you mentioned earlier in the interview, solar agriculture, where we're dependent on the sun mainly, and... Or is this just, you know, are we heading down a hill too fast to save ourselves?
Oh, yeah, tough question. Tough question.
Didn't mean to put that on your head.
You could say ideally we could do that. I mean, in truth, we've probably boosted the human population of the planet to a level that we can really only sustain.
Mm-hmm.
So unless we can imagine a way where there's fewer of us in the future, and, you know, that can be either a tough or a different kind of vision. It's a hard one to address, really. But, you know, at the very immediate level, there are a lot of things you can do to take the pressure off. And certainly, clearly, consuming less animal products, and if you're inclined, none at all.
Mm-hmm.
The local sourcing of food is really, really critical. And, you know, just imagine that if you converted from spending money on meat, you know, you would have extra money to spend on organic vegetables and give those people who are trying to meet that economic challenge, which isn't easy, a bit of a boost there. But really, in the end, we need to be conscious that this long free ride on oil, it just cannot go on for a long time. And those of us who are sensitive to these things at the moment will be well aware that this is a very, very big discussion and a very critical one. And so, you know, speaking for my organization and my own convictions, I would say to people, you know, find a role in this big transition. We need changes now, and the role can be, you know, in your own home, but take it outside. Be an activist for something. That's my message.
Oh, that's fabulous. Thank you so much, Dr. Campbell. My co-host Marge has a question for you.
Yes. I would like you to comment on the nutritional value of food grown with using so much oil, and also about the organic food. Is the soil so polluted by all the pesticides, herbicides, and whatever that have been used for years that now the organic produce isn't really what we would hope it would be now that it's growing on this soil?
Yeah, you're taking me a tiny bit outside my field. I think it's probably true that, almost certainly true, that food that's grown in as close to natural conditions is going to be healthier than food that's pumped up by artificial nutrients. Now, personally, I would worry more about the pesticide applications than I would about the artificial nutrients. Mm-hmm. Organisms are really tough. I mean, I'm not sure they can tell one form of nitrogen from another. They just turn it into protein, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure that, you know, food that's had fertilizer added is going to be as bad for you as food that's been sprayed to kill bugs.
I see.
What I do know is that, you know, we just can't keep doing it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And apart from all of the nutritional and health arguments, it's at the bottom end of it, it's really become a practical consideration and also a security issue. Like, if you imagine that oil becomes limiting and food transportation and production depends on oil, then, you know, the very basis of our comfortable lives is at question. And I think this is the way I think about it anyway.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
This makes me want to grow an organic garden in my backyard and make sure I'm okay if anything happens like that, like what you say, if, you know, if our nation collapses, I don't think any of us would be able to feed ourselves for much longer than a few days.
Well, that's right. I mean, the world has less than 2 months of grain supply for corn and wheat. It used to be that there would be several months worth kept. And these days, with the competition from biofuels and so on for any of those high-quality organics, is making it hard for people to actually store stuff. That, you know, economically, it makes more sense to sell it right away. So, you know, there's many, many other ramifications to this discussion that we didn't get into.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. I could talk about it forever. Do you have any questions for our guy, Alan? How are you doing?
Thank you.
Our technician's been listening with avid interest.
Yeah, right.
Well, I finally, let me just make a quick pitch for my organization.
Definitely.
Sierra Club in BC, you know, works on a whole range of environmental issues, not just seafood, but we're working in forests and climate change. We're involved. We have an Enviro 911 question line for people who have any kind of questions on an environmental issue and you want an answer. We have university students who'll research that for you.
Fabulous.
We have outings. We, if you have kids, you'll probably see our education team. They contact about 10,000 students a year. And if you just Google Sierra Club BC, you can have a look at what we do, and we would love to hear from you and even find some support from you. That would be fabulous.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Campbell, for your time. We've really appreciated having you.
Thanks, Kendall, and thanks to your team. This is a great service.
Oh, great. You're very welcome.
Okay.
That was a wonderful interview. Oh, yeah, so much information, so much to think
about.
Yeah,
it was excellent. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Really enjoyed that. You are listening to CFRO 102.7 on your FM dial, Co-op Radio, and this program is Animal Voices. Now, Alan, we'll have a little music.
Yeah, I thought Dandelion's I Am an Animal would be appropriate here somehow.
Very appropriate. Good.
And live from beautiful Camp Orca Island on Orcas Island. John C., Dandelions, and the Endangered Predators. We got any animals out there?
Yeah!
I am an animal.
Yeah. You are an animal.
Yeah.
We both are animals.
Yeah.
We eat like animals.
Yeah.
We dance like animals.
Yeah.
We love like animals.
Yeah.
We all are animals. We all are animals. The reptiles have some class. They slither about in the grass. They like it when the weather's damp. They party deep in the swamp. They got smooth and shiny scales, long tongues and longer tails. Ooh.
The birds do it all with their beaks. They eat and they clean and they speak. Their wings take them high in the air. And who knows what they do up there? They've got dances that can't be beat. With their feathers and rubber feet. Tweet, tweet. Let's hear some birds out there.
I am an animal.
Hey!
You are an animal. We both are animals.
Yeah.
We eat like animals.
Yeah.
We dance like animals.
Yeah.
We love like animals.
Yeah.
We all are animals.
Yeah.
We all are animals.
Yeah.
The insects have some pride. The weather skeletons outside. They can live anywhere. Hot or cold, they do not care. With antennas and many eyes, they eat, reproduce, and they die.
The mammals are a wild bunch. They eat each other for lunch. They got fur as soft as silk. They feed their babies milk. They sing all the latest tunes. At night they howl at the moon.
Thank you.
have a howl, welcoming back the wild wolf to Washington.
The fish dig a whole other scene. Their whole world is aquamarine. Some are thin and some are fat. Some of their faces are flat. They take transatlantic trips. They do strange things with their lips. Phew!
I see some fish lips out there. But let's not forget the plants. The plants have so much fun. They don't eat anyone. They just soak up with the sun. They rub the branches in the breeze. The dandelions tickle the trees.
I am an animal. You are an animal. We both are animals. We eat like animals. We dance like animals. We love like animals. We all are animals. We all are animals. I am an animal. I am an animal.
That was Dana Lyons and John Seed from the CD All Night They Howl at the Moon. And the sentiments stated, expressed in that song are something we need to keep in mind, that I am an animal, same as the other animals. We're all the animals are, we're all the same. We're all animals.
And we all feel.
And we all feel. And that thing you're going to talk about now, Marge, with somebody you know, using a hammer on the puppy dog is something that people just don't realize, that, you know, like, we are an animal the same as the, he wouldn't, probably wouldn't do it on a baby, he might, but probably not, somehow animals are fair game.
I'm sure many of you listeners have read about or heard about this terrible incident in the West End of Vancouver with the pit bull puppy, 15 weeks old. It was allegedly beaten to death with a hammer, blows to its head. Neighbors in the West End apartment where this occurred called the police. The police came and went into the apartment, found a dead puppy in the bathroom. Now, their next act was to call the Vancouver, the BC SPCA, and that caused an officer to go out and investigate, and she was told that the puppy had bitten a resident of the apartment building, and so she checked that, and apparently there had been a bite. But she said it may not have been an aggressive bite, a 15-week-old puppy. It could have been a teething problem. So that little puppy was beaten to death, probably from trying to soothe his sore gums. Anyway, this has been reported in the newspapers and radio and so forth, and the SPCA has recommended that charges be laid, cruelty charges, and that now has happened, so that there are two accusations that have been, or charges that have been sworn. And one is two counts of animal cruelty, and the other one count of mischief. I was a little puzzled by mischief. I thought this is certainly more than mischief. But apparently the mischief was due to the disturbance in the apartment building. So that it's not that this wasn't a cruel act to the animal. Now, so I was curious then, what if he were convicted, what would the result be of the conviction? What the worst possible thing that could happen to this individual? And the Vancouver Sun reported that if convicted, the accused faces a maximum fine of $2,000, up to 6 months in jail, and a prohibition on owning an animal for 2 years. Now, I thought, is he going to be any better after being fined and being jailed? and prohibited for 2 years. At the end of 2 years, is that going to make him a responsible, caring animal owner? I don't think so.
You never know, right?
No,
I mean, that's
we don't
all the criminal justice system can do. But
yeah.
At least.
But
a lifetime ban seems a lot more. A lifetime ban on
exactly.
Owning animals sounds
a lot better. Yeah, exactly. I agree
wholeheartedly. Yeah, it's not the same thing. A lifetime ban for sure. I mean, 2 years is ridiculous. Right?
No reason for that, that length of time. And what about rehabilitating this individual? It doesn't mean that he's lost forever, does it? It means he might be, I mean, we would assume or hope that he would at least be rehabilitated. But there's no mention of that. Now, surely to goodness he could be educated and conditioned rather than simply punished.
Yeah, it's a matter of if there is somewhere. I mean, obviously the idea of educating people and trying to get them to understand why what they did was wrong when they commit an offense is much better than putting them in jail. I mean, you know, it makes much more sense if you can somehow set up a system whereby people will have to go to counseling and to group therapy or whatever they'd have to go to so they end up discussing what they've done with other people and maybe start to understand why what they did was wrong. Like if somebody does something like this, certainly didn't understand what he was doing was wrong. I mean, it's a totally bizarre thing. I mean, you hear a lot of stuff in the media about puppy mills and people mistreating animals, but this is a pretty extreme case.
It absolutely is. And the other thing that comes into my mind is the fact that people who are this insensitive to other species are not entirely that sensitive to humans, and they may go on to injuring or killing even a human. So you have to bear that in mind, too, and for that reason, you need to rehabilitate them, and that should be a top priority.
Mm-hmm. I think, too, we ought to consider this happened on the downtown east side, right, Marge?
No, in the West End.
Oh, in the West End.
In a high-rise apartment in the West End.
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah, so
I know.
What you're thinking of a drug issue?
Well,
I
was thinking it was, you know, if this is someone who's, you know, financially down and out and has other problems those problems would need to be solved first. But this is, I guess,
no, it's somebody who committed a lunatic act, and who knows why? I mean, and then who knows if he has a history of that sort of thing or what anything else? But it was an extraordinarily bizarre act.
Yeah, and the problem with this issue too is that you know, like we're all saying, well, why can't there be a lifetime ban? And you know, what about rehabilitation? And what are these punishments severe enough? And that's often the dilemma of people who are trying to punish, for example, what you mentioned, Ellen, puppy mill people as well. But the animal cruelty laws are very difficult to enforce. We don't have a lot of officers enforcing them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the laws really haven't been updated in 20-some years.
The province has just moved to make some changes in animal cruelty legislation. I can't remember off the top of my head what it is, but they've funded an officer and made it easier to charge people who commit cruel acts against animals. We should actually look into what the details are, but I know just a few weeks ago there was some changes made in provincial legislation.
That's great.
Yeah. Well, and two people have worked now for years to get federal legislation changed. And in fact, I guess it was about 2004 that many humane groups were pressuring the government to pass legislation. I think it was Bill C-21. And what happened was that this was delayed and delayed. The Senate, I know, was partly responsible for delaying it. And eventually it got watered down so much that the Humane Societies decided it really wasn't worth passing anyway. So that it's sort of back to square one. But this is certainly something, legislation, that needs to be improved, and enforcement, of course.
I agree. Right. I subscribe to, and this is something I definitely recommend, the SPCA has an e-newsletter that goes out, and in one of the recent ones they were talking about the fight to have animals declared on the Constitution as sentient beings and how that would be kind of the solution to a lot of them, a lot of our animal welfare issues, because if animals are sentient beings, then we can't treat them the way we do in factory farms. We can't raise them in the conditions of puppy mills.
The agriculture industry would be lobbying against that. Right?
That's what happened.
That's the exact problem, Ellen, is that the government is so, agriculture is one of the number, like one of the top three moneymakers in our government, in our country. Agriculture is a huge business. And the government is not interested in doing anything that's going to curtail its finances. And having animals declared sentient beings would really cut everything at the knees, literally, you know?
Yeah, instead they come under some regulation saying that established industry practices are accepted. And you know what established industry practices are with chickens, for example, hens in cages laying eggs endlessly until they're slaughtered.
The first time I saw a great little, I think it's about a 20-minute or 30-minute film on that. I mentioned the last time we talked about this, Wegmans Cruelty, Wegmans, wegmanscruelty.com. Mm. That is an eye-opener. I had no idea that eggs were raised that way. Eggs were produced that way. So, it's a terrible issue, but unfortunately money's behind it, so... Since money's behind it, the number one solution is, as consumers, just to start making better choices.
But Marge has pointed out a couple of times on recent shows that there has been some changes in terms of free-range or at least free-run eggs being purchased by large retailers and organizations that provide food to institutions. So there's some change being made in that, however small it is. But in terms of factory chickens for food, I haven't heard any changes in that, and that is probably even more gross. The way these chickens are kept in these tiny cages, and it's a little conveyor belt comes along with seeds, and they're just kept in there for a few weeks until they get to be whatever size, and it's really unconscionable. And I, even though I've heard a lot about the movement towards free range eggs, I haven't heard anything towards about a movement towards free range poultry.
No, although that does get some coverage, doesn't it? I've seen it, movies and so forth about it. But I imagine when the free-range egg battle is won, then the poultry, broiler chickens, I think they're called, they'll come into the focus at that time.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it, Marge, is sort of one step at a time. And the eggs issue is so, like, I just see that as so doable. Like, it's... I mean, I don't know anyone who can't, well, you know, maybe that's not fair to say, but I think most people would easily pay an extra $3 a week or whatever, however long a dozen eggs lasts you, for free-range eggs. If they were to see this movie that I told you about, like, it's just so repulsive, and it's filthy and it's cruel the way they produce eggs. Mm-hmm. But it's so easy to get... to make the switch to free-range eggs. They taste better, they're more nutritious, the yolk's a more appealing color, and the good you do for these chickens is huge. And then once that change is made, then, let's sort of work through the industry.
And we're just talking about chickens and eggs here. There's obviously all the other aspects of the animal food
factory
industry.
Farming.
Right?
Well, anyway, next week we've... we are going to have a representative from the BCSPCA to talk to us about animal cruelty, and we'll be able to ask her a few questions about these laws. I'm sure that she'll be up on that, so that that's something worth looking forward to.
Great.
Now, I do have a story, unless someone has something more urgent.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, we have lots of time, so
okay,
go ahead.
Good enough. This is a very short story. It's called Killer Angels. I have just graduated... Right off the bat, wrong word. I had just graduated from veterinary school, and I was volunteering at a local shelter in Twin Falls, Idaho. As I looked down at the dog napping in her run, I knew I was going to have to wake her up to put her to sleep. What a cruel euphemism. She was a Heinz 57... mixed breed with no name, no home, no hope. She was horrifically malnourished, and her coat was a mass of mats and burrs. In a way, she was lucky to be here, found on the side of the road like living garbage. She'd been left to die in a remote area of our county. The kind rancher who found her brought her to the local shelter, where she joined dozens of other cuties and uglies pressing against the front of the cages, hoping to catch the eye of someone who had a heart and home big enough to give them a chance. Problem was, there were too many homeless pets and not enough homes. Day after day for a week, the dog waited and waited, her still wagging tail marking the time. But on this day, her time was up. No one had adopted her. Like many in the shelter, the animals were too big, too small, too hairy, too young, too old. Without enough cages to hold all that came through our doors, we were prepared to end her life quickly and without suffering, better than starving to death in the country, I said finally, with a little solace. I was inspired to enter this profession because of a deep love of animals. I had been highly trained and entrusted to save lives and prevent pain and suffering. Yet here I was about to end the life of this innocent creature. I hated this part of the job, but I had to do it. Choking back my emotions, I readied myself to perform the procedure for which I'd been trained. I set her on the table, and she wiggled her gaunt frame with delight as I spoke with soothing words and patted her head. The tempo of her tail quickened as she looked up at my face. Looking into her eyes, I saw total trust, unconditional love, and absolute loyalty. I felt the cruel irony of what was taking place. God's precious creatures, embodying the kindest virtues on the planet, being killed for the crime of not being wanted. She held out her leg for me to inject and licked my hand. She was ready. I wasn't. I collapsed on the dog and held her tight as I bathed her with tears. Never, ever would I do a convenient euthanasia again. I'd euthanize a dog or pet if it was suffering terribly or had an incurable disease, but never again because of an uncaring owner's mere request. I took the dog back to my veterinary practice and named her G.H., short for Good Home. I'd observed over the years that people who raise litters of puppies or kittens always said, "I just want to find them a good home." I soon entrusted G.H. to a loving client who had a heart and home big enough to welcome yet another four-legged family member. Saving G.H. set me on a new path as a veterinarian. Although my hands still held the power of death, my heart didn't. Now, whenever I look into the dancing liquid eyes of a pet brimming with love, I realize that looks can save. They did me. And that's by Dr. Marty Becker, veterinarian.
And that's from Chicken Soup for the cat and dog lover's soul. That was so nice. You know, I'm so glad that story ended the way it was, because I was just like, I can't take euthanasia lesson
I like that ending, too.
John Pranger, who was around here, John is taking a break now, but mm-hmm. that was his area, anti-vivisection and euthanasia, and we did a lot of items around that. Mm-hmm. I wanted to mention that I've noticed in the paper here that tomorrow at Van Dusen Gardens there's a bird walk. Birding for Beginners with Jeremy Gordon from Nature Vancouver, January 12th, 10 a.m. at Van Dusen Botanical Gardens, 5251 Oak. That telephone was talking to us. At Van Dusen Gardens at 5251 Oak. Free for members of the Vancouver Natural History Society or members of the Van Dusen Gardens. Or with admission to the gardens. I should mention that Nature Vancouver, also known as the Vancouver Natural History Society, has walks all the time. It's a big organization, the Vancouver Natural History Society, with people interested in birds and botany and geology and anything you can think of under the general heading of natural history. And the organization does a great deal, but every weekend they have walks somewhere in Greater Vancouver that anybody can go on. You don't have to be a member. And the phone number for for Nature Vancouver is 737-3074, 737-3074, or you can just go to their website, Nature Vancouver or Vancouver Natural History Society. And if you've never done that and checked it out, I'd suggest you do. If you have any interest in wild animals or natural history of any type, you'll find that there's an incredible resource there, because all kinds of people who are real authorities in various aspects. Is it too loud?
No, you're cutting out.
Oh, I'm okay in my ears.
Okay.
All kinds of people who have a lot of background in these areas are part of the organization and lead these walks.
Yeah, anyway, it's so great. There's so much to learn in our own environment that we don't know about.
Huge amount, and you can do it through this organization.
That's fabulous. Well, I've got a few just brief news items that are a little uplifting. Not uplifting, but not as sad as some of the ones we've heard today. This is interesting. A new grade 12 course on social justice must include animal rights because oppression and exploitation affects more than just humans, an animal activist told an exclusive meeting of educators and social justice experts recently. Leslie Fox of the Vancouver Humane Society told the group that speciesism is a prejudice just like racism or sexism, and it deserves inclusion in the groundbreaking Social Justice 12 course. Speciesism is a relatively new term, and it involves assigning values or rights to beings on the basis of their species. And speciesism is discriminating against other species because they aren't Homo sapiens. We aren't trying to make Social Justice 12 into an animal rights course, but it's my opinion that if we're going to discuss social justice concepts such as oppression and exploitation, animals should be included. I'm so excited about that. I think that's fabulous news. And another bit of good news, I'm sure all of you have heard of the Cloverdale Rodeo. A popular suburban Vancouver rodeo has eliminated four marquee events from its future program. According to the Canadian Professional Rodeo Association, the CPRA, Cloverdale is the first rodeo in Western Canada to dramatically change its programs in response to animal rights activists. I love hearing that because it means activism does make a difference.
Absolutely.
So exciting. The CPRA, the Canadian Professional Rodeo Association president, says he's concerned that a, quote, cherished Western tradition is under attack, but by removing the events, Cloverdale risks losing its designation as a sanctioned professional rodeo, where cowboys on the North American circuit can earn points to qualify for the national and North American championships. But that's okay, because the four events that they are eliminating, which are considered the most cruel, are calf roping, team roping, steer wrestling, and something I've never heard of, a cow milking race, which does sound awful. Mm-hmm. So I just thought that was fabulous. The last quote says, the times have changed. Said the president of the CPRA, the ability to do and be what we were has to be reviewed. So that's fabulous. And, you know, in Western Canada, we really love our rodeos, and times are changing.
Oh, yes.
I'm really excited to see that.
It's so wonderful. I know that I know some of the activists who were out there running onto the rodeo grounds and throwing themselves at gates and all kinds of things. But it worked.
So
it's
great.
It's absolutely fabulous. Now, the next big show in rodeo that needs to have something done is the Calgary one.
I know.
That is huge.
And I'm from Calgary, and I grew up going to the Stampede, and, you know, I did remember noting with horror the calf roping event. They just tossed that little guy around, so.
Yeah,
times are changing, so. I'm happy to hear that.
Those are good news items.
It's good to hear that, too, because as someone who's getting into animal activism, it sometimes gets depressing. You know, I think, oh, what's the point? And, you know, is this going to make any difference?
Oh,
and
this
it
is
definitely
a time.
Does.
I think we're on a roll.
Yeah, times are changing.
The chickens and so on, the laying hens. Oh, that's big.
Yeah, and if the next generation of kids are all getting Social Justice 12 and becoming aware of animal rights, you know,
sure,
being launched into adulthood more conscious and caring consumers.
Right. Yeah. Well, Ellen, any further comment?
We have a couple of minutes left, but I totally agree that, I mean, we played that song "I Am an Animal," which emphasizes this thing. What they're doing in Social Justice 12, in terms of breaking down that species barrier that separates human beings from other animals, there's various reasons why that's happened, but nonetheless, there is that change in consciousness that's happening, and it's it is great to see that to some degree it's happening. Unfortunately, you know, people like our premier here in British Columbia are moving the wrong direction, and there's a lot of things that are happening going the wrong way, but still, there are all kinds of small examples that you're pointing out, and at least people are speaking out, say, about fish farms. I mean, 20 years ago, there wouldn't have been many people speaking out about them.
That's right.
Now there are.
They're making the news headlines, too, aren't they? And this is very encouraging. When the media comes on board, that's really big news. Mm-hmm. And as like the Compass Group, which is a huge one for distributing egg distribution to food providers, well, that is a really big gain in itself, and that's coming now across many educational institutions that are following. Well, they have to. That's where they get their provisions, so they have to follow. But I guess we're just about out of time.
Okay,
we've got a minute or two.
I've just got one more last comment about the one minute. about this speciesism. Mm-hmm. I like this comment that speciesism is, they've equated it with racism and sexism, and the idea. I find it really exciting that one day, to be a speciesist will be as horrifying as it is to be accused of being a racist,
or sexist,
yeah, exactly.
Sure.
And I like to think one day that people will look back in horror at the way we raised animals for meat and the way we, and also the way we treat our environment, in the same way that we look with horror at how we once, enslaved the world.
Yeah,
enslaved people from Africa.
Time to sign
off. I'm being cut off before I go on.
Thank you for listening to CFRO.
Thank you for listening.
102.7 FM, and this is Animal Voices. Please join us again next Friday when we'll be back with an SPCA officer.